Martin, welcome. Last week, we had a conversation about the tightrope of balancing learning excellence and financial performance, and particularly sustained financial performance. And you asked, can AI solve Bloom's Two Sigma problem 70 years after Bloom devised the Two Sigma problem? Tell us about that.
Benjamin Bloom is an American distinguished professor, educationist, thinker, and he had a remarkable influence on education in all sorts of ways. I mean, many people will have heard of Bloom's taxonomy, which is an ordered system of learning. It's the idea that you start off by essentially memorizing. Right at the bottom, there's rote learning, and you move up through different hierarchies in Bloom's taxonomy until you come to the point where you can get to abstract thinking. And that's widely used. But Bloom did a lot more than that. And what's remarkable about him is that he was one of the first people to really use credible statistics in analyzing education outcomes. I mean, it comes as a surprise to many people to learn that statistics is a relatively recent discipline. You know, before there was just mathematics. And the application of statistics to sort of big social issues and economic issues is basically, you know, a function of the last 50 or 60 years. So Bloom was an early pioneer in that field, and he was very interested in educational statistics. And the great advantage of doing this kind of work in the United States is America, of course, is first of all very large education systems, and they tend to have very good data. Because you can't do anything in education statistics really without longitudinal data. Otherwise, you can't establish cause-effect relationships. You can't really track things. You know, we all know that education is investment for a lifetime. So if you really want to know what the value of your university degree is, there's not much use in asking that question a year after you've graduated, because you'd probably be traveling the world or working as a barista or something like that. You know, you have to get long data series to try and find out efficacy. So Bloom was interested in this. And he was particularly interested in what correlates with strong performance in essentially either university level or college level or schooling systems. And what he found, which we now pretty well take for granted, but it was pretty fundamental at the time, was that the primary determinant of success beyond obviously individual aptitude, we're talking here at the cohort level, not the individual aptitude, we're talking about basically the average performance of a group of students, is that what he found was that the chance of success was very strongly correlated with the size of the class. In other words, the ratio of the class size teacher to student. The two sigma bit is sort of the statistical expression of the variance of what he found and how to solve this. And essentially, what he said was that the smaller the class, going down to a situation almost of individual tuition, the more probability there was that a person, when averaged out to equalize out individual aptitude, was going to succeed. Now, intuitively, we know that because class size is a statistic that they use all over the world. I mean, we know that very well here in South Africa, where, for example, we have extreme economic inequality. And we have public schooling systems, government schools, where class size can vary from 70 or 80 to 25 or 30. And that's a statistic that everybody uses. But the reason why he posed it as a problem is a bit more interesting than that. Because, of course, he was interested in government public schooling systems. And, of course, the challenge with that is that the kicker is that it becomes more and more unaffordable the more that you go down that road. And so the problem was, how do we get out of this trap where education attainment is essentially indexed with the ability to pay? And in one way or another, that's a problem for education systems just about all over the world. So here in South Africa, we're very well aware of it. How does a kid with natural aptitude, how does a class, how does an average child succeed if there are more than 80 kids in the class in standard 8, which is still a situation in some of our rural schools? How does that child succeed? In contrast with an X Model C school where there might be 32 in the class. So that we know. But it's also applicable elsewhere in the world as well, because what's actually happening is across the world, now I'm talking about the university sector, the tertiary sector, across the world, what's happening is that the cost of tuition is increasing significantly higher than the general rate of consumer inflation. And that, by economists, is actually called the cost disease, There have been papers written about this, of a higher education delivery model. And that then leads university systems to come into conflict with government regulation. For example, right in the United Kingdom right now, recent studies have shown that up to a third of British universities are at risk of insolvency over the next couple of years, largely because there fee levels are set by government regulation as a maximum. Politically, it's almost impossible for the government to relax that, and universities can't come out at that government-regulated fee section. And again, here in South Africa, I'm sure families despair about the cost of supporting a student at WITS or UCT or whatever. So this problem is not just a schooling problem. It's not just a South African problem. It's a global problem in education. So to go back to your core question, how does AI come into this picture? We're in a very interesting stage at the moment with considering AI applications. And if you think about the Gartner acceptance curve, which basically is used a lot, and says with new innovations, what happens is you originally get the hype, the hype part of the curve. There's this sort of amazing release of a new information, and we can't talk about anything else. Some people totally despair, some people celebrate. Now, you know, when ChatGPT was launched, we saw that classically. Some people went, say, this is going to change humanity. Other people said it's the end of the world as we know it. Then you basically get the deflation, where everybody basically goes down to the bottom, and then you gradually get a stabilization. Now, we're going into the stabilization phase of ChatGPT. Now, it's kind of like older news. You know, it's not hyped so much. There's still a bit of despair stuff going on, but it's not. And what we found in a whole bunch of fields, of which probably the best example here is the health sciences, AI applications are at their most useful when they take over a whole bunch of back office functions and routine functions. And they do things like providing doctors with better opportunities to see their patients. And there's no evidence, for example, in health sciences that AI applications, back office applications, are actually replacing doctors. I mean, we don't see a bot when we go to the doctor. We see the doctor. The doctor's been relieved of a lot of time. So immediately, you've got a potential application in education, because a great deal of what goes on in large class sizes, and any teacher will say that, you all have experienced this in your own lecturing, is probably as much as 80% of what you do in providing feedback in a class or feedback after an assessment event is pretty routinized, actually. You almost have, you know, when that student hand goes up in the third row and asks a question, half the time your heart sinks because you've had that question 100 times before. Your answer is ready almost to give before the student has finished articulating their problem. Now, that is pattern recognition, because we are using pattern recognition, and pattern recognition is what generative AI does very well. In fact, it does it better than humans. So we've already seen some very interesting applications of AI in tutoring. Probably the best example is the Khan Academy in the United States, which has introduced already AI tutoring, for example, to help American students prepare for the SAT tests, which are essential for admission to any college and university in the United States. And these applications are dealing with the routinized aspects of teaching. They tend to be better, as we would expect, in the technical disciplines, the sciences and mathematics, than they do in the humanities. It's easier to correct a routine mistake in an algorithm in mathematics than it is, for example, to provide tutorial support for an essay on Macbeth. And so it's uneven, but we're already seeing that. Now, that goes to the heart of Benjamin Bloom's two sigma problem, because what it means is we've now got a technical solution, which means that it should drive down the cost of providing the equivalent of getting close to one-to-one support. In other words, the dream, Bloom's dream of one-to-one support, becomes feasible when you think through the future of AI applications. Now, at the moment, the only thing that's stopping this going to scale, which will change, quite frankly, is the remaining high cost of tokens for anybody using, and you know, anybody who's used a a paid ChatGPT or equivalent application will know that it's actually quite expensive. And this makes it, at the moment, still difficult. But we know from all applications in the digital field, you know, the cost drops. I mean, we've seen that phenomenally in the cost of storage. This will happen with tokens. The cost will go really down. And then we're going to see some very, very interesting developments.
Bruce Whitfield said this in a talk recently apropos of AI. We're probably overhyping it in the short term and underestimating it in the long term. I remember I did a paper 8 years ago, and the statistic then was that the average age of first-time homeowners in America was early 40s, with a direct correlation of that to student fee debt. So the assumption was if student X graduates at the age of 25, it'll take them 15 to 20 years to work that debt off so that then they can start qualifying for a mortgage. So within that, what do you attribute the imbalance between learning priorities and commercial priorities? What do you attribute that fault line, that very common fault line to?
That's a very good question. It's very easy to dismiss universities and universities' leadership as being out of touch with market forces, you know, too tied up in their academic concerns to appreciate real world concerns, you know, and arguments, well, we should just get a good business manager in there and we'll sort the universities out. It's actually much more complicated than that. You know, one of the difficulties, again, goes back to Bloom in a very interesting way. Because if you think about that taxonomy of learning that I outlined, and the other taxonomies as well, Bloom's isn't the only one, but they all are similar. If we're talking about routine training functions, then the argument for strict commercialization, competition, driving down prices really holds water very well. So, for example, you know, if you want to go on a training course to get competence in a very clearly defined function that can be laid out in a handbook. I mean, I did a spec a while ago as part of a project on, you know, we have a great shortage in South Africa of people who are qualified to be engineers for solar installations. So one of the things that holds back our just transition to, you know, a different energy regime is the lack of skilled people. Now, in fact, what happens if you get into this business is that any electrician has to be retrained to a solar installation. But you can codify simply every single step of the installation. Literally, you can write, you know, you remember the old days, David, we used to have things called handbooks. We don't have them anymore now. We've got to watch YouTube all the time, right? But you could read the handbook. You could read the handbook. And if you're trying to understand something in Microsoft Word, you went to page 63 and it told you exactly which button to check, right? Now, you can still do that with these kind of installations, and that happens often within apprenticeship models. Now, there, I think, you're getting down to a commercial application, and you can do it sensibly in that way. What we're trying to do, though, in most other education, increasingly for lifelong learning for professionals who have to keep go back and change. You know, something comes along that fundamentally changes the premises of your profession. It's happened to everybody in financial services, for example, with blockchain applications. You've got to relearn everything. And how do you do that? And it's not just a matter of reading the handbook. You've got to think very carefully about premises. You've got to be thinking critically about it. You've got to be doing a whole bunch of other things to understand the context. You know, you can't just read the book like a machine. That's why our education systems need to be able to protect that kind of environment. And so I think that always needs to be taken into account. Let me give you an example as well. Throughout the world, every now and again, you get a new minister of education who comes in, takes one look at what's going on and saying, why are we wasting our time on performing arts, creativity, drama, all of these things? We just need science, engineering, and technology and we're going to basically close down this stuff and not offer these degrees anymore. You know, every now and again that happens. And all that happens as a result of that is that you are potentially creating generations of very skilled engineers and technicians that have no appreciation of social context. Let me give you an example. We're obviously very, very concerned through COVID about the science of generating new vaccines. And we saw the real power of health scientists across the world in working flat out and saving millions of lives through generating a vaccine in rapid time. All right. But then the other half of all of that in terms of dealing with the COVID thing was vaccine denialism. It turns out that vaccine denialism, I mean, you know, a lot of the scientific types would say, well, these are just stupid people who don't understand science. It turns out it's much, much more complex than that. The reason why people are reluctant to have vaccinations are very, very complex. And the only thing that can interpret that, and, you know, there's a very good meta study on this that was recently released, looking at literature all over the world, is that it's really, really complex. And you can't understand vaccine denialism and the public health dimensions of that without having sociologists and historians and other people who think that way. So what our contemporary universities do is they achieve that balance. So this is why there's not a rapid adoption to it. Universities' responses to generative AI have been very interesting. Initially, and it's exactly what you said about the hype thing, initially, the sentiment across a lot of university people who says, we've got to ban this. We've got to ban this. Everybody's going to cheat. We must prohibit it, right? It took about 2 or 3 months for people to realize that was A, impossible, and B, employers were going to want people who knew how to use generative AI. So most universities have now switched, and they're taking a constructive view of how to use it. And there's been some very interesting new developments going on across this field. There's a lot of very interesting startups being generated out of universities, which are looking at where we can use AI for grading, where we can use AI for tutorial support for back office functions. So we're seeing this stuff beginning to settle into the education system. For schooling, a really great example is the New York public school system. The New York public school system initially banned AI, and then within about 3 or 4 months, the commissioner in charge of the New York public school system did a complete public reversal and embraced the technology. And again, working with organizations like the Khan Academy, there's now quite a lot of initiatives going on within schooling systems about how it can be incorporated. And what's coming out is the right balance. So, for example, a number of state guidelines have been issued in the US. There's been a national guidance from the federal education authorities. And the fundamental principle in the area we're talking about this morning, which I rather like, is the guiding principle is there must always be, quote, a human in the loop. So nobody is advocating for the use of AI in education and learning that simply hands this whole process over to machines. What they are saying is we need practices, as with the health sciences, that free teachers to spend more time teaching so they can concentrate on those students who need their attention. That's the one thing, reduce the workload on teachers. The other thing is to Where we're dealing with anything that is involved in pattern recognition, where a generative AI solution will do it better than a human, like rote marking very large examination sets of examination scripts, for example, then the human in the loop is that you would shift from using humans from being the primary markers of examination scripts to being the moderators, because we need much more moderation. But I like that sort of human in the loop principle. And that's a good example of how these practices are becoming pragmatic, but also ethical in their considerations and concerns. So we're not about to be, generative AI is not going to take us over. A lot of people confuse generative AI with general AI. General AI, most people think, is going to happen, but it's probably 15 or 20 years off. Now, this is the sort of thing that meets the Turing test. General AI is a machine that can actually think as well as a human. Generative AI is very sophisticated pattern recognition. And what ChatGPT is doing is that it constantly reprograms itself. That's the generative in the generative AI. So AI has been around for a long time, but you had to do a lot of programming to set the parameters. Now what happens is generative AI intelligently works out its own parameters. So it's constantly improving and scanning at a very rapid rate. That doesn't replace humans. So we're seeing the field mature. We're seeing some very sensible suggestions, and we're seeing some very interesting new developments sort of beginning to come online. I was talking to someone who is still stuck in the old-fashioned thing of having to mark hundreds of handwritten scripts at a leading university. And I asked her, could she see when she was marking the handwritten scripts because in some cases these were open book examinations and things like this. Could she see the influence of AI? And she said, yes, she can see it all the time, because basically she can see how the style of writing suddenly changes. And in my own work of looking at my students' dissertations, I can tell straight away when a student has plagiarized. I can see the style change. The thing about this is that the best way of actually, and plagiarism, of course, is a problem that's been with us forever, but the best way of detecting plagiarism and the best way of detecting the use of AI to affect plagiarism is to use an AI application to, in fact, spot the style change, because you can, of course, program, you can prompt engineer a ChatGPT application to look for style changes that indicate that some of it's been written by an AI application.
What one thing can you provide as a prompt to academic and corporate education providers to do or to keep top of mind in their efforts to get a better balance between learning excellence and sustained financial performance?
I mean, you made a number of interesting points there, really relevant points. And I mean, I think the one issue that we've got to do is we've got to get over this ridiculous distinction between vocational and higher education. I mean, it was introduced as a time when there was an obsession with the hierarchy of learning, and nobody wanted universities to be associated with technical colleges, which were a lesser order. And I mean, if you go back to that, you know, there was this filtering process going on where whatever your national examination system was, whether it was the National Senior Certificate here in South Africa, where basically we have this internal distinction between getting the National Senior Certificate and attaining a so-called bachelor's pass, which qualifies you for university. That's a filter. It's a differentiator. You want to send one bunch of people off who have less ability to go and do vocational education, you know, in our TVET colleges in South Africa, what else? And that same hierarchy stuff exists. United States, four-year colleges versus two-year colleges, Britain, further education colleges versus universities, etc. That's not appropriate to the world today. And I think, you know, in terms of concepts like action and applied learning, the one that I like is the concept of work-integrated learning, because we're all preparing for some form of work. Now, that work might be to become a computer scientist. But there's other forms of work as well. I mean, the university that I had the privilege of leading in the United Kingdom, we were ridiculed in the popular press because we had the only full degree program in the country in stand-up comedy, comedy studies, right? Comedy's work, it's work. And there are people whose vocation is to do that. That's what they want to do in life. And they're very good at it. And there's all sorts of stuff that you've got to learn, including a combination of, in practical terms, how to be a comedian, how to organize your stage, how to write a script, how to manage lighting, microphones, all sorts of other things. But then also quite philosophical things, is ethical things about, you know, you can do harm as a comedian. So it's a work integrated program. And if we begin to reconceptualize our categorization, a lot of other stuff will follow from it. So then you get a question is, well, once you're thinking about this, what's your appropriate level of expenditure? And it varies very, very much according to what you're doing. And some forms of provision are relatively inexpensive to supply and others are not. And an educational institution needs to achieve a degree of cross-subsidization to make that happen. And governments need to have that in mind in their subsidy approaches. And that balance needs to be preserved, and it's what good educational institutions do well. There are very few university leaders who I've come across who have a simple blanket approach and say, well, it's not my problem, the government's got to provide more subsidy. Everybody's realistic about this. You know, the days of huge government subsidies to education have gone, wherever you are in the world. Everybody's aware of this. What they need to do is to find a way of conceptualizing it that allow affordable solutions to be developed and applied. And I think concentrating more on integration with the world of work. And that's also important, because the other thing, of course, that we're now a long way away from were the days when, you know, as you began to contemplate your university career at the age of 16 or 17 and start having thoughts and conversations about where you want to do, your career advisor was there basically essentially guiding you to think about what you wanted to do for the rest of your life. That's now a ridiculous conversation. I mean, all sorts of us are actually in professions that didn't exist when we made those decisions. Now what we've got is we've got an awful lot of uncertainty in the world. We've got change happening all the time. We have happenstance opportunities that we need to take advantage of, and we have new fields of practice opening up. So basically, we're in an age of continual lifelong learning, and that learning is integrated with work, however we define it. And I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not following a narrow functionist approach to work. I mean, work can be working as an artist. Work can be working as a comedian. Work can be working as a philosopher or a musician. These are all work. And the question of how we learn and how we keep learning has to be integrated into that so that the right cost basis can be found for it. And I think that's achievable. I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the education landscape over the next 5 to 10 years, but we're going to see some very interesting ideas coming out too.